Chapter 10 Blue Sky and Goodbye. Linus slept restlessly that night. She had frightening dreams in which something dangerous was lurking in the darkness. When the lights went on in the morning and she opened her eyes, her first thought was of the door in the pipeworks. And then, right away, she felt a thud of disappointment, because the door was locked, and someone else, not her, knew what was behind it. She went in to wake Granny.
"Time to get up," she said,
but Granny didn't answer. She was lying with her mouth half open and breathing in a strange, hoarse way.
"Don't feel too good,"
she finally said in a weak voice. Lina felt Granny's forehead. It was hot. Her hands were very cold. She ran for Mrs. Murdo, and after that, to Cloving Square, to tell Captain Fleary she would not be coming to work today. Then she ran to Oliver Street, to the office of Dr. Tower, where she banged on the door until the doctor opened it. Dr. Tower was a thin woman with uncombed hair and shadows under her eyes. When she saw Lina, she seemed to grow even more tired.
"Dr. Tower," Lina said, "my grandmother is sick. Will you come?"
"I will," she said, "but I can't promise to help her. I'm low on medicine."
"But come and look. Maybe she doesn't need medicine."
Lina led the doctor the few blocks to her house. When she saw Granny, the doctor sighed.
"How are you, Granny Mayfleet?" she asked.
Granny looked at the doctor blearily.
"I think ill," she said.
Dr. Tower laid a hand across her forehead. She asked her to stick out her tongue, and she listened to her heart and her breathing.
"She has a fever," the doctor told Lina. "You'll need to stay home with her today. Make her some soup. Give her water to drink. Put rags in cool water and lay them across her forehead."
She picked up Granny's bony hand in her rough, reddish one.
"What's best for you is to sleep today," she said. "Your good granddaughter will take care of you."
And all day, that's what Lina did. She made a thin soup of spinach and onions and fed it to Granny a spoonful at a time. She stroked Granny's forehead, held her hand, and talked to her about cheerful things. She kept Poppy as quiet as she could. But as she did all this, in the back of her mind was the memory of the days of her father's illness, when he seemed to grow dim, like a lamp losing power, and the sound of his breathing was like water gurgling through a clogged pipe. Though she didn't want to, she also remembered the evening when her father let out one last short breath and didn't take another. And the morning a few months later, when Dr. Tower emerged from her mother's bedroom with a crying baby and a face that was heavy with bad news. In the late afternoon, Granny got restless. She lifted herself up on one elbow.
"Did we find it?"
she asked Lina.
"Did we ever find it?"
"Find what, Granny?"
The thing that was lost," Granny said. "The old thing that my grandfather lost."
"Yes," said Lina.
"Don't worry, Granny. We found it. It's safe now." "Oh, good."
Granny sank back onto her pillows and smiled at the ceiling.
"What a relief," she said.
She coughed a couple of times, closed her eyes, and fell asleep. Lina stayed home from work the next day as well. It was a long day. Granny dozed most of the time. Poppy, delighted to have Lina at home to play with, kept toddling over with things she found. Dust rags, kitchen spoons, stray shoes, and whacking them against Lina's knees, saying,
"Play with this! Play with this!"
Lina was glad to play with her, but after a while she'd had enough of spoon banging and rag tugging and shoe rolling.
"Let's do something else," she said to Poppy. "Shall we draw?"
Granny had drunk a full cup of soup for dinner and was falling asleep again, so Lina got out her colored pencils and two of the can labels she'd been saving. They were white on the back and made good enough drawing paper if you flattened them out. With their sharpest kitchen knife, she whittled the pencils into points. She gave the green pencil and one can label to Poppy, and she herself took the blue pencil and smoothed out the other can label on the table. What would she draw? Taking hold of a pencil was like opening a tap inside her mind, through which her imagination flowed. She could feel the pictures ready to come out. It was a sort of pressure, like water in a pipe. She always thought she would draw something wonderful, but what she actually drew never quite matched the feeling. It was like when she tried to tell a dream. The words never really captured how it felt. Poppy was grasping the pencil in her fist and making a wild scribble.
"Look it!"
she cried.
"Lovely," said Lina.
Then, without even a clear idea of what it was to be, she began her own picture. She started on the left side of the can label. First, she drew a tall, narrow box, a building. Then more boxes next to it, a cluster of buildings. Next, she drew a few tiny people walking on the street below the buildings. It was what she nearly always drew, the other city. And every time she drew it, she had the same frustrating feeling. There was more to be drawn. There were other things in this city. There were marvels there. But she couldn't imagine what they were. All she knew was that this city was bright in a different way from Ember. Where the brightness came from, she didn't know. She drew more buildings and filled in the windows and doors. She put in street lamps. She added a greenhouse. All the way across the paper, she drew buildings of different sizes. All the buildings were white, because that was the color of the paper. She set her pencil down for a moment and studied what she'd done. It was time to fill in the sky. In the pictures she'd done with regular pencils, the sky was its true color, black. But this time, she made it blue, since she was using her blue pencil. Methodically, as Poppy scratched and scribbled beside her, Lina colored in the space above the buildings, her pencil moving back and forth in short lines until the entire sky was blue. She sat back and looked at her picture. Wouldn't it be strange, she thought, to have a blue sky? But she liked the way it looked. It would be beautiful, a blue sky. Poppy had started using her pencil to poke holes in her paper. Lina folded up her own picture and took Poppy's away from her. "Time for dinner," she said. Sometime deep in the night, Lina woke suddenly, thinking she'd heard something. Had she been dreaming? She lay still, her eyes open in the darkness. The sound came again, a weak, trembling call.
"Lina!"
She got up and started for Granny's room. Though she had lived in the same house all her life, she still had trouble finding her way at night, when the darkness was complete. It was as if walls had shifted slightly, and furniture moved to new places. Lina stayed close to the walls, feeling her way along. Here was her bedroom door. Here was the kitchen, and the table. She winced as she stubbed her toe on one of its legs. A little farther, and she'd come to the far wall and the door to Granny's room. Granny's voice was like a thin line in the dark air.
"Lina, come and help.
I'm coming, Granny," she called. She stumbled over something, a shoe maybe, and fell against the bed.
"Here I am, Granny,"
she said. She felt for Granny's hand. It was very cold.
"I feel so strange," said Granny.
Her voice was a whisper.
I dreamed about my baby, or someone's baby."
Lina sat down on the bed. Carefully, she moved her hands over the narrow ridge of her grandmother's body until she came to her shoulders. There, her fingers tangled in the long wisps of Granny's hair. She pressed a finger against the side of Granny's throat to feel for her pulse, as the doctor had shown her. It was fluttery, like a moth that has hurt itself and is flapping in crooked circles.
"Can I get you some water, Granny?"
Lina asked. She couldn't think what else to do.
"No water," Granny said. "Just stay for a while."
Lina tucked one foot underneath her and pulled part of the blanket over her lap. She took hold of Granny's hand again and stroked it gently with one finger. For a long time, neither of them said anything. Lina sat listening to her grandmother's breathing. She would take a deep, shuddering breath and let it out in a sigh. Then there would be a long silence before the next breath began. Lina closed her eyes. No use keeping them open. There was nothing to see but the dark. She was aware only of her grandmother's cold, thin hand and the sound of her breathing. Every now and then, Granny would mumble a few words Lina couldn't make out, and then Lina would stroke her forehead and say,
"Don't worry. It's all right. It's almost morning," though she didn't know if it was or not.
After a long time, Granny stirred slightly and seemed to come awake.
"You go to bed, dear," she said. "I'm all right now."
Her voice was clear but very faint.
"You go back to sleep."
Lina bent forward until her head rested against Granny's shoulder. Granny's soft hair tickled her face.
"All right, then," she whispered. "Good night, Granny."
She squeezed her grandmother's shoulders gently, and as she stood up, a wave of terrible loneliness swept over her. She wanted to see Granny's face, but the darkness hid everything. It might still be a long time until morning. She didn't know. She groped her way back to her own bed and fell into a deep sleep. And when, hours later, the clock tower struck six and the lights came on, Lina went fearfully into her grandmother's room. She found her, very pale and very still, all the life gone out of her. Chapter 11. Lizzie's Groceries. Lina spent all that day in Mrs. Murdo's house, which was just like theirs, only neater. There was one couch and one fat chair, covered in fuzzy striped material, and one big table, only Mrs. Murdo's table wasn't wobbly like theirs. On the table was a basket, and in the basket were three turnips, each of them lavender on one end and white on the other. Mrs. Murdo must have put them there, Lina thought, not just because she was going to have them for dinner, but also because they were beautiful. Lina sat sideways on the couch with her legs stretched out, and Mrs. Murdo covered her with a soft, gray-green blanket. "This will keep you warm," she said, tucking it around Lina's legs. Lina didn't really feel cold, but she did feel sad, which was, in a way, the same. The blanket felt good, like someone holding her. Mrs. Murdo gave Poppy a long purple scarf to play with and made a creamy mushroom soup with potatoes. And all day Lina stayed there, snuggled under the blanket. She thought about her grandmother, who had had a long and mostly cheerful life. She cried some and fell asleep. She woke up and played with Poppy. The day had a strange but comforting feel to it, like a rest between the end of one time and the beginning of another. On the morning of the next day, Lina got up and got ready to go to work. Mrs. Murdo gave her beet tea and spinach hash for breakfast. "The singing's coming up soon," she remarked to Lina as they ate. "Do you know your part?"
"Yes," said Lina. "I remember it pretty well from last year."
"I rather like the singing," said Mrs. Murdo.
"I love it," Lina said. "I think it's my favorite day of the year."
Once a year, the people of the city came together to sing the three great songs of Ember. Just thinking of it made Lina feel better. She finished her breakfast and put on her red jacket. "Don't worry about Poppy. I'll take care of her," said Mrs. Murdo, as Lina headed for the door. "When you come back this evening, we'll talk about how to proceed."
"Proceed?" said Lina.
"Well, you can't live by yourselves, just the two of you, can you?"
"We can't?"
"Certainly not," said Mrs. Murdo sternly. "Who's to take care of Poppy while you go off delivering messages? You must move in here with me. I have an empty bedroom, after all, and quite a nice one. Come and look." She opened a door at the far end of the living room, and Lina peeked in. She had never seen such a beautiful, cozy room. There was a big, lumpy bed covered with a faded blue blanket, and at its head, four plump pillows. Next to the bed was a chest of drawers with drawer handles shaped like teardrops and a mirror attached to the top. The carpets on the floor were all different shades of blue and green, and in the corner was a sturdy square table and a chair with a back like a ladder. "This will be your room," said Mrs. Murdo. "Yours and Poppy's. You'll have to share the bed, but it's big enough."
"It's lovely," Lina said. "You're so kind, Mrs. Murdo."
"Well," said Mrs. Murdo briskly, "it's just common sense. You need a place? I have one. You go on now, and I'll see you this evening." 3 days had passed since Lina and Dune had seen the man in the pipeworks, and there hadn't been any special announcements. So if that man had discovered a way out of Ember, he was keeping the news to himself. Lina couldn't understand why. As Lina ran through the city with her messages on her first day back to work, it seemed to her that the mood of the people was even gloomier than before. There were long, silent lines at the markets, and knots of people gathered in the squares, talking in low voices. Many shops, more each day it seemed, displayed signs in their windows saying "closed" or "open Monday, Tuesday only." Every now and then, the lights flickered, and people stopped and looked up in fright. When the flickering ended and the lights stayed lit, people just took a breath and walked on. Lina delivered her messages as usual, but inside she felt strange. Everywhere she ran, she heard the same words like a drumbeat in her mind. "Alone in the world, alone in the world." It wasn't exactly true. She had Poppy, she had friends, and she had Mrs. Murdo, who was somewhere between a friend and a relative. But she felt as if she had suddenly gotten older in the last 3 days. She was a sort of mother herself now. What happened to Poppy was more or less up to her. As the day went on, she stopped thinking "alone in the world" and began thinking about her new life at Mrs. Murdo's. She thought about the blue-green room and planned how she would arrange her pictures on the walls. The one she'd drawn with her blue pencil would look especially nice because it would match the color of the rugs. She could bring her pillows from home and add them to the ones on the bed, and then she'd have six altogether. And maybe she could find some old blue dresses or shirts and make pillow covers for them. The blue-green room, the orderly apartment, the meals cooked and the blankets tucked in cozily at night, all this gave her a feeling of comfort, almost luxury. She was grateful for Mrs. Murdo's kindness. "I am not ready yet to be alone in the world," she thought. Late that afternoon, Lina was given a message to take to Lampling Street. She delivered the message, and as she was coming back out onto the street, caught sight of Lizzie coming out the door of the supply depot. Her orange hair was unmistakable.
"Lizzie!" Lina called out.
Lizzie must not have heard her. She kept on going. Lina called again.
"Lizzie, wait!"
This time it was clear that Lizzie had heard, but instead of stopping, she walked faster.
"What's the matter with her?" Lina wondered.
She ran after her and grabbed the back of her coat.
"Lizzie, it's me!"
Lizzie stopped and turned around.
"Oh!"
she said. Her face was flushed.
"It's you! Hi! I thought it was... I didn't realize it was you."
She smiled brightly, but there was a distracted look in her eyes.
"I was just going home," she said.
Her arms were wrapped around a small, bulging sack.
I'll walk with you, said Lina.
Oh, said Lizzie. Oh, good.
But she didn't look pleased.
Lizzie, something sad has happened, Lina said. My grandmother died.
Lizzie gave her a quick sideways glance, but she didn't stop walking.
That's too bad, she said absently. Poor you.
What was wrong with her? Lizzie was ordinarily so interested in other people's misfortunes. She could be sincerely sympathetic, too, when she wasn't wrapped up in her own troubles. Lina changed the subject.
What's in the sack?
She asked.
Oh, just some groceries, said Lizzie. I stopped at the market after work.
You did? Lina was confused. She had seen Lizzie not 2 minutes ago, leaving the storeroom office. Lizzie didn't answer. She began walking and talking quite fast.
It was so busy today at work. Work is so hard, isn't it, Lina? I think work is much harder than school and not as interesting. You do the same thing every day. I get so tired, don't you, running around all day?
Lina started to say that she liked running and hardly ever got tired, but Lizzie didn't wait for her to answer.
Oh, well, at least there are some good things about it. Oh, guess what, Lina? I have a boyfriend. I met him at work. He really likes me. He says my hair is the exact color of a red-hot burner on a stove.
Lina laughed.
It's true, Lizzie, she said. You look like your head is on fire.
Lizzie laughed, too, and lifted one hand to fluff her hair. She puckered her lips and fluttered her eyelashes.
He says I'm as beautiful as a red tomato.
They were crossing Torrick Square now. It was crowded in the square. People had just left work and were lining up at the shops and hurrying along with packages. A cluster of children sat on the pavement, playing some sort of game.
Who is this boyfriend? Asked Lina.
But just at that moment, Lizzie tripped. She'd been strutting along being beautiful, not paying attention to her feet, and the edge of her shoe caught on an uneven place in the pavement. She staggered and fell, and as she fell, she lost her grip on the sack. It hit the ground and toppled sideways, and some cans spilled out. They rolled in all different directions. Lina reached for Lizzie's arm.
Did you hurt yourself?
She asked. But Lizzie went scrambling after the cans so quickly, it was clear she wasn't hurt. Wanting to help, Lina went after the cans, too. Two had rolled under a bench. Another was going toward the children, who were on their feet now, watching Lizzie's wild, spider-like motions. Lina picked up the cans under the bench, and for a second, her breath stopped. One of them was a can of peaches. Peaches, it said right on it. And there was a picture of a yellow globe. No one she knew had seen a can of peaches in years. She looked at the other one. It was just as amazing. Creamed corn, it said. Lina remembered having creamed corn once as a thrilling treat when she was 5 years old. There was a shout. She looked up. One of the children had picked up a can.
Look at this, he cried,
and the other children gathered around him.
Applesauce,
he said, and the children murmured,
applesauce, applesauce,
as if they had never heard the word before. Lizzie was on her feet. She had all the cans except for the two in Lina's hands and the one the child had picked up. She stood there for a moment, her eyes flicking back and forth from Lina to the children. Then she smiled, a bright, fake-looking smile.
Thanks for helping me, she said. I found these on a back shelf at the market. What a surprise, huh? You can keep those.
She waved the back of her hand at the children, waved again at Lina, and then took off, holding the sack by its neck so it hung beside her and banged against her legs. Lina didn't follow her. She walked home, thinking about Lizzie's sack of cans. You simply did not find cans of peaches and applesauce and creamed corn on the back shelves of markets. Lizzie was lying. And if the cans hadn't come from a market, where had they come from? There was only one answer. They had come from the storerooms. Somehow, Lizzie had gotten them because she worked in the storeroom office. Had she paid for them? How much? Or had she taken them without paying?
Mrs. Murdo had cooked a dinner of beet and bean stew for them that night. When Lina showed her the two cans, she gasped in astonishment.
"Where did you get these?" she asked.
"From a friend," said Lina.
"And where did your friend get them?"
Lina shrugged.
"I don't know."
Mrs. Murdo frowned slightly, but didn't ask any more questions. She opened the cans, and they had a feast. Creamed corn with their stew, and peaches for dessert. It was the best meal Lina had had in a very long time, but her enjoyment of it was tainted just a little by the question of where it had come from. The next morning, Lina headed for Broad Street. Before she started delivering messages today, she was going to have a talk with Lizzie. She spied her half a block from the storeroom office. She was sauntering along looking in shop windows. A long green scarf was wound around her neck. Lina ran up swiftly behind her.
"Lizzie," she said.
Lizzie whirled around. When she saw Lina, she flinched. She didn't say anything, just turned around and kept walking. Lina caught hold of one end of the green scarf and jerked Lizzie to a halt.
"Lizzie,"
she said, "stop."
"What for?"
Lizzie said.
"I'm going to work."
She tried to pull away, but she didn't get far because Lina had a firm grip on her scarf. Lina spoke in a low voice. There were people all around them. A couple of old men leaning against the wall, a group of chattering children just ahead, workers going toward the storerooms, and she didn't want to be overheard.
"You have to tell me where you got those cans," she said.
"I told you, I found them on a back shelf at the market. Let go of my scarf."
Lizzie tried to wrench her scarf out of Lina's grip, but Lina held on.
"You didn't," Lina said. "No market would just forget about things like that. Tell me the truth."
She gave a yank on the end of the scarf.
"Stop it!"
Lizzie reached out and grabbed a handful of Lina's hair. Lina yelped and pulled harder on the scarf, and the two of them scuffled, snatching at each other's hair and coats. They knocked against a woman who snapped at them angrily, and finally they toppled over, sitting down hard on the pavement. Lina was the first one to laugh. It was so much like what they used to do in fun, chasing each other and screaming with laughter. Now here they were again, nearly grown girls, sitting in a heap on the pavement. After a moment, Lizzie laughed too.
"You dope," she said.
"All right, I'll tell you. I sort of wanted to anyway."
Lizzie leaned forward with her elbows on her knees and lowered her voice.
"Well, it's this,"
she said.
"There's a storeroom worker named Looper. He's a carrier. Do you know him? He was two classes ahead of us. Looper Windley."
"I know who he is," said Lina. "I took a message for him on my first day of work. Tall, with a long skinny neck, big teeth, funny looking."
Lizzie looked hurt.
"Well, I wouldn't describe him that way. I think he's handsome."
Lina shrugged.
"Okay, go on."
"Looper explores the storerooms. He goes into every room that isn't locked. He wants to know the true situation, Lina. He's not like most workers who just plod along doing their jobs and then go home. He wants to find things out."
"And what has he found out?"
Lina asked.
"He's found out that there's still a little bit left of some rare things, just a few things in rooms here and there that have been forgotten. You know, Lina," she said, "there are so many rooms down there. Some of them, way out at the edges, are marked empty in the ledger book, and so no one ever goes there anymore. But Looper found out that they're not all empty."
"So he's been taking things?"
"Just a few things, and not often."
"And he's giving some to you?"
"Yes, because he likes me."
Lizzie smiled a little smile and hugged her arms together.
"I see," Lina thought. "She feels that way about Looper."
"But Looper's stealing," said Lina. "And Lizzie, he isn't just stealing things for you. He has a store. He steals things and sells them for huge prices."
"He does not,"
said Lizzie, but she looked worried.
"He does.
I know because I bought something from him just a few weeks ago. He has a whole box of colored pencils.
Lizzie scowled.
He never gave me any colored pencils.
He shouldn't be giving you anything or selling things. Don't you think everyone should know about this food he found?
No, Lizzie cried. Because, listen, if there's only one can of peaches left, only one person gets to have it, right? So why should everyone know? They'd just end up fighting over it. What good would that be?
Lizzie reached out and put a hand on Lina's knee.
Listen, she said. I'll ask Looper to find some good stuff for you, too. I know he will, if I ask him.
Before she had time to think, Lina heard herself saying,
What kind of good stuff?
Lizzie's eyes gleamed.
There's two packages of colored paper, he told me, and some cough medicine, and there's three pairs of girls' shoes.
It was treasure, colored paper, and cough medicine to cure sickness, and shoes. She hadn't had new ones for almost 2 years. Lina's heart raced. What Lizzie said was true. If everyone knew there were still a few wonderful things in the storerooms, people would fight each other trying to get them. But what if no one knew? What difference would it make if she had the colored paper or the shoes? She suddenly wanted those things so badly she felt weak. A picture arose in her mind's eye. The shelves at Mrs. Murdo's house stocked with good things, and the three of them happier and safer than other people. Lizzie leaned closer and lowered her voice.
Looper found a can of pineapple. I was going to split it with him, but I'll give you a bite if you promise not to tell.
Pineapple. That delectable long-lost thing that her grandmother had told her about. Was there anything wrong with having a bite of it, just to see what it was like?
I've already tasted peaches, applesauce, and a thing called fruit cocktail, said Lizzie, and prunes and cream corn and cranberry sauce and asparagus.
All that? Lina was astonished. Then there's a lot of special things like that still.
No, said Lizzie, not a lot at all. In fact, we've finished all those.
You and Looper?
Lizzie nodded, smiling smugly.
Looper says it's all going to be gone soon anyway. Why not live as well as we can right now?
But Lizzie, why should you get all that? Why you and not other people?
Because we found it. Because we can get at it.
I don't think it's fair, said Lina.
Lizzie spoke as if she were talking to a not very bright child.
You can have some too. That's what I'm telling you. There are still a few good things left.
But that wasn't the unfairness Lina was thinking of. It was that just two people were getting things that everyone would have wanted. She couldn't think how it should have been done. You couldn't divide a can of applesauce evenly among all the people in the city. Still, something was wrong with grabbing the good things just because you could. It seemed not only unfair to everyone else, but bad for the person who was doing it somehow. She remembered the hunger she'd felt when Looper showed her the colored pencils. It wasn't a pleasant feeling. She didn't want to want things that way. She stood up.
I don't want anything from Looper.
Lizzie shrugged.
Okay,
she said, but there was a look of dismay on her small, pale face.
Too bad for you.
Thanks anyway, said Lina, and she set off across Torrick Square, walking fast at first, and then breaking into a run. Chapter 12, A Dreadful Discovery. His way. He was pretty sure the door would be locked as usual. His mind was on other things. He was thinking of his green worm, which had been behaving oddly, refusing to eat, and hanging from the side of its box with its chin tucked in. And he was thinking about Lina, whom he hadn't seen for several days. He wondered where she was. When he came to the door, he reached absently for the knob, and what he felt startled him so much that he snatched his hand back as if he'd been stung. He felt again carefully. There was a key in the lock. For a long moment, Dune stood as still as a statue. Then he took hold of the doorknob and turned it. Very slowly, he pushed on the door. It swung inward without a sound. He opened it only a few inches, just enough to peer around the edge. What he saw made him gasp. There was no road or passage or stairway behind the door. There was a brightly lit room, whose size he could not guess at because it was so crowded with things. On all sides were crates and boxes, sacks and bundles and packages. There were mounds of cans, heaps of clothes, rows of jars and bottles, stacks of light bulb packages. Piles rose to the low ceiling and leaned against the walls, blocking all but a small space in the center. In that small space, a little living room had been set up. There was a greenish rug, and on the rug an armchair and a table. On the table were dishes smeared with the remains of food, and in the armchair, facing Dune, was a great blob of a person whose head was flopped backward, so that all Dune could see of it was an upthrust chin. The blob stirred and muttered, and Dune, in the second before he stepped back and pulled the door closed, caught a glimpse of a fleshy ear, a slab of gray cheek, and a loose purplish mouth. That day, Lina had more messages to carry than ever. There had been 5 blackouts in a row during the week. They were all fairly short. The longest was 4.5 minutes, Lina had heard. But there had never been so many so close together. Everyone was nervous. People who might ordinarily walk to someone's house were sending messages instead. Often they didn't even come out into the street, but beckoned to a messenger from their doorway. By 5 o'clock, Lina had carried 39 messages. Most of them were more or less the same. I'm not coming to the meeting tonight. Decided to stay home. I won't be in to work tomorrow. Instead of meeting me in Cloving Square, why don't you come to my house? The citizens of Ember were hunkering down, burrowing in. Fewer people stood around talking in groups under the lights in the squares. Instead, they would pause briefly to murmur a few words to each other, and then hasten onward. Lina was on her way home to Mrs. Murdo's. She and Poppy had moved in with all their things, when she heard rapid footsteps. Startled, she turned and saw Dune racing toward her. At first, he was so out of breath he couldn't speak.
"What is it? What is it?"
said Lina.
"The door," he panted. "The door in 351. I opened it."
Lina's heart leapt.
"You did?"
Dune nodded.
"Is it the way out?"
Lina whispered fiercely.
"No,"
Dune said. He glanced behind him. Clutching Lina's arm, he pulled her into a shadowy spot on the street.
"It doesn't lead out of Ember," he whispered. "It leads to a big room."
Lina's face fell.
"A room? What's in there?" "Everything. Food, clothes, boxes, cans. Light bulbs, stacks of them, everything. Piles and piles up to the ceiling."
His eyes grew wide.
"And someone was there, in the middle of it all, asleep."
"Who?" A look of horror passed over Dune's face.
"The mayor," he said. "Conked out in a big armchair, with an empty plate in front of him."
"The mayor?" Lina whispered.
"Yes. The mayor has a secret treasure room in the pipeworks."
They stared at each other, speechless. Then Dune suddenly stamped hard on the pavement. His face flushed red.
"That's the solution he keeps telling us about. It's a solution for him, not the rest of us. He gets everything he needs, and we get the leftovers. He doesn't care about the city. All he cares about is his fat stomach."
Lina felt dizzy, as if she'd been hit on the head.
"What will we do?"
She couldn't think, she was so stunned.
"Tell everyone," said Dune.
He was shaking with anger.
"Tell the whole city the mayor is robbing us."
"Wait, wait." Lina put a hand on Dune's arm and concentrated for a minute. "Come on," she said at last. "Let's go sit in Harkin Square. I have something to tell you, too." At the north end of Harkin Square stood a circle of believers, clapping their hands and singing one of their songs.
Lately, they seemed to be singing more loudly and cheerfully than ever. Their voices were shrill. "Coming soon to save us," they wailed. "Happy, happy day!" Near the gathering hall steps, something unusual was happening. 20 or so people were pacing around and around, carrying big signs painted on old planks and on big banners made of sheets. The signs said, "What solutions, Mayor Cole?" and "We want answers." Every now and then, the demonstrators would yell these slogans out loud. Lina wondered if the mayor was paying any attention. Dune and Lina found an empty bench on the south side of Harkin Square and sat down.
"Now listen," said Lina.
"I am listening," said Dune, though his face was still red and the look on his face was stormy.
"I saw Lizzie coming out of the storerooms yesterday," Lina said.
She told him about the cans and Lizzie's new friend Looper and what Looper was doing. Dune pounded his fist on his leg.
"That's two of them doing it, then," he said. "Wait, there's more. Remember how I thought there was something familiar about the man who came out the door? I've remembered what. It was that way he walked, sort of dipping over sideways, and also that hair, that black hair all unbrushed and sticking out. I've seen him twice. I don't know why I didn't remember who it was right away. Maybe because I've only seen him from the front. I took a message for him on my first day."
Dune was jiggling with impatience.
"Well, who was it? Who was it?" "It was Looper. Looper, who works in the storerooms. Lizzie's boyfriend. And Dune?"
Lina leaned forward.
"It was a message to the mayor that he gave me. And it was this. Delivery at 8.
Dune's mouth dropped open.
"So that means he's taking things from the storeroom for the mayor. And he's giving some to Lizzie and selling some in his store."
"Oh!" cried Dune.
He slapped his hand against his head.
"Why didn't I get it before? There's a hatch in the ceiling near Tunnel 351. It must go right up into the storerooms. Looper comes through there. That's what we heard that day, remember? A sort of scraping. That would have been the hatch opening. Then a thud. His sack of stuff dropping through. And then a sound like someone jumping down and landing hard on the ground.
And then walking slowly because he was carrying a load. And walking quickly on the way out because he'd left it all for the mayor."
Lina took a deep breath. Her heart was drumming and her hands were cold.
"We have to think what to do," she said. "If this were an ordinary situation, the mayor would be the one to tell."
"But the mayor is the one committing the crime," said Dune.
"So then, we should tell the guards, I guess," said Lina. "They're next in authority to the mayor, though I don't like them much," she added,
remembering how she'd been so roughly hustled down the stairs from the roof of the gathering hall.
"Especially the chief guard."
"But you're right," Dune said. "We should tell the guards. They'll go down into the pipeworks and see for themselves that we're telling the truth. Then they can arrest the mayor and have all the stuff put back in the storerooms, and then they can tell the city what's been going on."
"That's a much better idea," said Lina. "Then you and I can get back to what's more important."
"What?"
"Figuring out the instructions. Now that we know that the door we found wasn't the right one, we have to find the right one."
"I don't know," said Dune. "We might be all wrong about those instructions. They could just be about some old pipeworks tool closet."
He made a sour face.
"Instructions for Eggerston. Who's Eggerston? Or Eggersman, or whoever it was. Why couldn't he have been just an especially stupid pipeworks guy who needed instructions to find his way around?"
He shook his head.
"I don't know. I think maybe those instructions are just hogwash."
"Hogwash? What's that?"
"It means nonsense. I read it in a book in the library."
"But they can't be nonsense. Why would they have been kept in a box like that? With a strange lock?"
But Dune didn't want to think about the instructions right then.
"We'll figure it out tomorrow," he said. "Right now, let's go find the guards."
"Wait," said Lina, catching hold of the sleeve of his jacket. "I have one more thing to tell you."
"What?"
My grandmother died.
Oh, Dune's face fell. That's so sad, he said. I'm sorry.
His sympathy made tears spring to Lina's eyes. Dune looked startled for a moment, and then he took a step toward her and wrapped his arms around her. He gave her a squeeze so quick and tight that it made her cough, and then it made her laugh. She realized all at once that Dune, thin, dark-eyed Dune with his troublesome temper and his terrible brown jacket and his good heart, was the person that she knew better than anyone now. He was her best friend.
Thanks, she said. Well,
she smiled at
him. Let's go and talk to the
guard. They crossed the square and climbed the steps of the gathering hall. Sitting at the big reception desk outside the door of the mayor's office was the assistant guard, Barton Snowd, the same one Lina had encountered her first time here. Snowd looked bored. His elbows were on the desk, and his chin was moving very slowly from side to side.
Sir, said Dune, we need to speak with you.
The guard looked up.
Certainly, he said. Go right ahead.
In private, said Lina. The guard looked puzzled. His small eyes darted back and forth.
This is private,
he said.
No one here but me.
But anyone could come along, said Dune. What we have to say is secret and very important.
Very important?
Said Snowd.
Secret?
His face brightened. Grunting, he raised himself up from his chair and motioned them into a narrow hallway off to the side of the main hall.
What is it?
He said. They told him. As they spoke, interrupting each other to make sure they got in all the details, the guard's eyebrows gradually lifted higher and higher over his eyes.
You saw this room?
He said.
This is true? Are you sure?
He was chewing faster now.
You mean the mayor? You mean the mayor is...
At that moment, a little way down the hall, a door opened. Through it came three more guards, including, Lina spotted him by his beard, the chief guard. They strode forward, talking to each other in low voices, and as they passed, the chief guard threw a quick glance at Lina.
Does he recognize me?
Lina wondered. She couldn't tell. Barton Snowd finished his sentence in a husky whisper.
You mean the mayor is stealing?
That's right, said Dune. We thought you should be informed, because who else can arrest the mayor? And once you've done that, the guards can put all the things he's stolen back where they came from.
And then tell the city that a new mayor has to be found,
added Lina. Barton Snowd leaned heavily against the wall and rubbed a hand over his chin. He seemed to be thinking.
Something must be done, he said. This is shocking. Shocking.
He started back toward his desk, and Dune and Lina followed.
I will make a note,
he said, taking a pencil from the desk drawer. Lina watched as he wrote slowly on a scrap of paper.
Mayor, stealing. Secret. Room.
When he'd finished, he let out a satisfied breath.
Very good, he said. Action will be taken. You may be sure. Some sort of action. Quite soon.
Good, said Dune. Thank you,
said Lina, and they turned to leave. The three guards were standing by the main door of the gathering hall as Dune and Lina went out. The chief guard moved aside to make way for them, and they went through the door and out onto the wide front steps. Lina glanced over her shoulder. Before the door swung closed, she saw the chief guard striding toward the reception desk, where Barton Snowd was standing up, leaning forward, his eyes shining with important news. Chapter 13. Deciphering the Message. Dune headed for home, and Lina went in the opposite direction across Harkin Square. The little group of believers had gone, but the protesters with their signs continued to pace back and forth.
A few of them were still shaking their fists in the air and yelling, but most of them tramped silently, looking tired and discouraged. Lina felt a bit that way, too. Once Dune said he'd seen a door, she was sure that the door he'd found and the door in the instructions were the same. She had had such hopes for that door in the pipeworks, but hoping so hard had made her jump to conclusions. She'd gone a little too fast. She always went fast. Sometimes it was a good thing, and sometimes not. Now Dune thought the instructions were nothing important after all. She didn't want him to be right. She didn't believe he was, even now. But her thoughts felt like a mess of tangled yarn. She needed someone wise and sensible to help her sort things out. She headed for Gloam Street. Though it was nearly 6 o'clock, she found Clary still in her workroom at the far end of Greenhouse 1. It was a small, crowded room. Pots and trowels cluttered a high table at one end. Above the table were shelves full of bottles of seeds and boxes of string, wire, and various kinds of powders. Clary's desk was a rickety table, littered with scraps of paper, all of them covered with notes in her neat, round handwriting. Two rickety chairs went with the rickety table, one on each side. Lina sat down, facing Clary.
"I have to tell you some important things," she said, "and they're all secret."
"Oh, all right," said Clary. "I can keep secrets." She was wearing a patched shirt that had faded from blue to gray. Her short brown hair was tucked behind her ears, and a bit of leaf clung to it on the right-hand side. She folded her arms in front of her on the desk. She looked square and solid.
"The first thing is," Lina began, "that I found the instructions, but Poppy had chewed them up."
"The instructions," said Clary. "I'm not familiar with them." Lina explained. She went on to explain everything. How she'd shown the instructions to Dune. What they had figured out. How he'd searched the pipeworks and found the door. And what he'd seen when he opened the door. Clary made an unhappy sound and shook her head. "This is very bad," she said. "And sad, too. I remember when the mayor was first starting out. He has always been foolish, but not always wicked. I'm sorry to know that the worst side of him has won out." Clary's dark brown eyes seemed to grow deeper and sadder. "There is so much darkness in Ember, Lina. It's not just outside. It's inside us, too. Everyone has some darkness inside. It's like a hungry creature. It wants and wants and wants with a terrible power. And the more you give it, the bigger and hungrier it gets." Lina knew. She had felt it in Looper's shop as she hovered over the colored pencils. For a moment, she felt sorry for the mayor. His hunger had grown so big it could never be satisfied. His huge body couldn't contain it. It made him forget everything else. Clary let out a long breath, and a few of the scraps of paper on her desk fluttered. She ran her fingers through her hair, felt the bit of leaf, and plucked it out. Then she said, "About these instructions."
"Oh, yes," said Lina. "They might be important, or they might not be. I don't know anymore."
"I'd like to see them, if you'd let me."
"Of course you can see them, but you'll have to come home with me."
"I'll come now, if that's all right," said Clary. "There's plenty of time before lights out." Lina led Clary up the stairs and into her new bedroom at Mrs. Murdo's. "Nice room," Clary said, looking around with interest. "And I see you have a sprout."
"A what?" said Lina.
"Ear bean," said Clary, pointing at the little pot of dirt on the windowsill. Lina bent to see what Clary was talking about. Sure enough, the dirt was heaving up a little. She touched the pushed-up part, brushed away the dirt, and discovered a pale green loop. It looked like a neck, as if a creature in the bean were trying to escape, but hadn't yet managed to pull its head out. Of course, she already knew that plants grew from seeds, but to have put that flat white bean in the dirt, to have almost forgotten about it, and now to see it forcing its way up into the air.
"It's doing it," she said. "It's coming to life."
Clary nodded, smiling. "Still amazes me every time I see it," she said. Lina brought out the instructions, and Clary sat down at the table to study them. She puzzled over the patchwork of scraps for a long time, tracing the lines with her finger, murmuring the parts of words.
"What you've figured out so far seems right to me," she said. "I think Ip Ork must be Pipeworks, and Iverb N.K. must be Riverbank. So this bit must be down Riverbank. Then there's a big space here. To Edge. Edge of what, I wonder? And does it mean down Riverbank as in walk alongside the river?"
"Yes, I think so," Lina said.
"Or does it mean go down the riverbank itself, down the bank toward the water? Maybe edge means edge of the water."
"It couldn't mean that. The bank goes straight down like a wall. You couldn't go down to the edge of the water. You'd fall in."
Lina pictured the dark, swift water and shivered.
"This word," said Clary, putting a finger on the paper. "Maybe it isn't edge. Maybe it's something else. It could be hedge or pledge. Those don't make much sense. But it could be ledge or wedge."
Lina saw that Clary was no better at deciphering the puzzle than she was. She sighed and sat down on the end of her bed.
"It's hopeless," she said.
Clary straightened up quickly.
"Don't say that. This torn-up piece of paper is the most hopeful thing I've ever seen. Do you know what this word is?"
She pointed to the word at the top of the paper, Eggers.
"Someone's name, isn't it? The title would be Instructions for Eggerston, or maybe Eggersman, or something like that. The person the instructions were for."
"I don't think so," said Clary. "If you add an S to this word, right where this tear in the paper is, you get egress. Do you know what that means?"
"No," said Lina.
"It means the way out. It means the exit. The title of this document is Instructions for Egress."
When Clary left, there was still over an hour before lights out. Lina raced across the city to Greengate Square. She glanced in the window of the small items shop, where Dune's father was reaching for something on a shelf, and then she dashed up the stairs and knocked on the door of Dune's apartment. Right away, she heard quick steps, and Dune opened the door.
"I have something exciting to tell you," Lina said breathlessly.
"Come in, then."
Lina went across the cluttered room to stand by a lamp. She pulled from her pocket a tiny piece of paper on which she had written egress.
"Look at this word," she said.
"It's from the title of the instructions. Someone's name," said Dune.
"No,"
said Lina.
"It's meant to be egress, with two S's. I showed the instructions to Clary, and she told me. It means the way out."
"The way out?" cried Dune.
"Yes, the way out, the exit. It's instructions for the way out of Ember."
"So it is real," Dune said.
"It is. We have to figure out the rest, or as much of the rest as possible. Can you come now?"
He darted into his room, emerged with his jacket, and they ran.
"All right," said Lina.
They were on the floor of the blue-green room at Mrs. Murdo's.
"Let's take the first line."
She moved her finger along it slowly.
"One, exp, riv, Ip Ork. We know that Ip Ork is Pipeworks," she said. "Exp could be expand or explore or expose."
"There's a big space between exp and the rest," said Dune. "There must be more words in there."
"But who knows what they are? Let's move on."
Lina swept her straggly hair impatiently back from her face.
"Look at number two. Two. Stun, marked with E, by
S-T-U-N-R-D-G-E.
Lina put her finger on stun.
What could that be?
Maybe piston, said Dune. That's part of a machine, like the generator. Or maybe it's astonish. Or it could be...
I bet it's just plain stone, said Lina. There's a lot of stone in the pipeworks.
Dune had to admit this was probably right.
So then, he said, it would be stone marked with E.
He frowned at the next bit.
This must be River's Edge. Stone marked with E by the River's Edge.
They looked at each other in delight.
E for egress, cried Lina. E for exit.
They bent over the document again.
There's not much left of this next line, said Dune. 3. Addy, down, iverb, and K. To edge, APPR, 8, low.
Just this part, which must say, down riverbank to edge, something.
Edge of water would make sense, but right after edge, there's app. What would that be?
Dune sat back on his heels and gazed up at the ceiling, as if the answer might be there. Lina muttered,
down riverbank to edge, edge.
She thought of Clary's guesses about that line.
Maybe it's ledge, she said. Down riverbank to ledge. There could be a ledge down near the water.
Yes, that must be right. There's a stone marked with E, and down the riverbank at that point there's a ledge. I think we're getting it.
Once again they crouched over the page, their heads close together.
Okay,
Dune said.
Line 4.
4.
Axe to the... Wat... R. Find door of bow... Kerr. K-E... Hind small steel pan... The right. Rem, E-Y, open, doe.
This is where it says door, Lina said. Somehow, the door is by the ledge. Does that make sense?
And then there's that small steel pan. What can that mean? What would a pan have to do with anything?
But look!
Lina tapped the paper urgently.
Here it says K-E, and here it says E-Y. It's talking about a key.
But what is it a door to? Said Dune, sitting back. Remember, we thought about this before. A door in the bank of the river would lead under the pipeworks.
Lina pondered this.
Maybe it leads to a long tunnel that goes way out beyond Ember, and then gradually up and up until it comes out at the other city.
What other city?
Dune glanced up at the drawings tacked to the walls of Lina's room.
Oh, he said. You mean that city?
Well, it could be.
Dune shrugged.
I suppose so. Or it could be another city exactly like this one.
That was a gloomy thought. Both of them felt their spirits sink a little at the idea. So they turned back to the task of deciphering.
Next line, said Lina.
But Dune sat back on his heels again. He stared into the air, half smiling.
I have an idea, he said. If we do find the way out, we'll need to announce it to everyone. Wouldn't it be splendid to do it during the singing? Stand up there in front of the whole city and say we found it?
It would be, Lina said, but that's only 2 days away.
Yes, we have to hurry.
They were bending again over the glued-down fragments when Dune remembered that he should check the time. It was 9:15. He barely had time to get home.
Come again tomorrow, said Lina, and while you're at work, look for the rock marked with E.
That night, Dune had trouble sleeping. He couldn't find a comfortable position on his bed. It seemed to be made up of nothing but lumps and wrinkles, and it squeaked and groaned every time he moved. He flailed around so much that the noise woke his father, who came to his room and asked, "What is it, son? Nightmares?"
"No," said Dune. "Just can't sleep."
"Are you worrying? Frightened of anything?"
Dune wanted to say, "Yes, Father. I'm worried because the mayor of our city is taking for himself the things that people need, and I'm afraid because any day our lights could go out forever. I'm worried and afraid a lot of the time. But I'm also excited because I think there is a way out, and we might find it, and all those feelings are whirling around in my head, which makes it hard to sleep."
He could have told his father everything. His father would have plunged in with great enthusiasm. He would have helped them decipher the instructions and expose the mayor's thievery. He would have even come down into the pipeworks and helped search for the rock marked with E. But Dune wanted to keep these things to himself for now. Tomorrow, the guards would announce that an alert young boy had uncovered the mayor's crime, and his father, hearing the announcements along with the rest of Ember, would turn to the person next to him and say, "That's my son they're talking about. My son." So in answer to his father's question, he simply said,
"No, Father. I'm all right."
"Well then, see if you can't lie still," said his father. "Good night, son," he added, and closed the door. Dune smoothed out his covers and pulled them up to his chin. He closed his eyes. But still, he couldn't sleep. So he tried a method that had often worked for him before. He would choose a place he knew well, the school, for instance, and imagine himself walking through it, picturing it as he went in minute detail. Often his thoughts would wander, but he would always bring them back to the imaginary journey, and something about doing this would often make him sleepy. This night, he decided to retrace his explorations of the pipeworks. He held his mind to the task for a long time, picturing, with all the clarity he could muster, everything he had seen in that underground realm. The long stairway, the tunnels, the door, the path along the river, the rocks along the path. He felt sleep drawing closer, a heaviness in his limbs. But just as he was about to give in to it, he saw in his mind's eye the wrinkled rocks that bordered the river at the west end of the pipeworks. The rocks, whose strange ridges and creases had reminded him of writing. His eyes flew open in the dark. His heart began to hammer, and he gave up on sleeping and lay in a state of terrible impatience for the rest of the night.